Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson. The first week in September with Nature Now. This time of year finds the maples are slowly developing red leaves. Sunset is earlier as we approach the fall equinox. That's really noticeable. There are ample berries around to feed us and other animals, and the night skies are shining. This week is the full harvest moon. For this show, we'll join Ann Sowell, hydrologist, for analysis of the current water supply for September. We know it's generally dry, but how dry? And first, a few local observations, and Alex Henley is going to help me with those, starting with, this is owl pellets, another local forest business. Seattle children dissected owl pellets in the fourth grade and many other grades, but where did the teachers get them? Easy. They order them from owl pellet businesses, several of them based in the Pacific Northwest. And one of the teachers said, when the kids begin dissecting the pellets, they engage in discovering what their owl ate and comparing their findings with their classmates. Barn owls swallowed their prey whole, resulting in a particularly prized owl pellet containing nearly entire skeleton. Pellets from many types of owls are sold to distributors, where they are heated, then wrapped for shipment. Most of the buyers are schools, museums, and other institutions that use them for science projects. This was started by a biology professor at Western Washington University, Erwin Selznick, who pioneered the use of pellets in classrooms, and then he paid people to collect them from the wild. When he retired, some of the collectors opened their own businesses. Protecting the owl privacy is vital, especially during nesting and fledgling, because after all, the pellets may appear to be free, but the hard work is already done by the owl. This was in the Seattle Times on August 30th, 2020.
How did the Earth get its water? Recent speculation tracks back over 4.5 billion years to Earth's formation from dust, rock bits, and meteorites. Because it formed relatively close to the sun, there would not have been ice in the early mix. For many years, scientists have believed that water came from far out in the solar system, carried by comets or water-rich asteroids that hit the existing Earth. Several French researchers recently investigated a rare meteorite found on Earth, present at the early formation. Chondrite meteorites compose a large portion of the building block rocks that accreted over time to compose the Earth. They concluded that these contained enough hydrogen to contribute to water presence on the early planetary mix. In fact, if you built a planet out of this material, you'd have at least several oceans worth of water, says one scientist. Thus, the materials for water may lie in Earth's basic components. This theory says its components were with Earth as it formed, rather than arriving later from deep space. Perhaps it's always been here. It was an article in Science magazine.
And for our mystery sound, you might not see this bird unless you are standing near or even in fast-moving fresh water. Hi, today we are talking to Ann Sowell, who is a hydrologist. She's the resource manager for the city of Sequim, and one resource she focuses on is water. She spent several decades studying where it comes from and where it goes on the Olympic Peninsula. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. I thought perhaps we could set the scene a little bit. When we talked in May, we were talking about snowpack and where it was and the possibilities of the summer. Well, here we are in the first week of September, having gotten through a fairly dry August, despite that little splash of rain on the last day of August. And I'm wondering if we can just, for right now, think, what is it people see? I'm looking at the Olympics and they look like there's no snow or very little snowpack. I put a shovel in the ground in my garden on Sunday and went down 6 inches of absolutely dry soil. So how do you want to talk about the realities of what's happening right now? Just what is it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a great time to be checking in after the last time we talked, being when the snow account was at its fullest for the 2020 water year. And yeah, we saw lots of great snow fields up there at that time because we had a pretty good snowpack. Here we are 3 months later. Wow. You're right. It looks like it's gone. There's actually some hidden snow fields, probably hidden from the eye from down here. If you get into the mountains, you see them, and there are glaciers. They're not all gone, but there are glaciers that remain. They're all a lot smaller. Yeah, our August and September water availability is completely dependent on what snow is left to melt and whether or not we get rain. And then also, of course, in the rivers, there's something called base flow, but that's kind of a different story. So what most people think about is, you know, is the snow still melting and do we have any rain coming?
Uh-huh. So we tend to just say, well, it's a drought, but there's different sources of that drought, right? One being the snow or absence of it and rain or absence of it. So they're two very distinct things, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, you just explained it. Yep. One is an absence of snowpack and one is the absence of rain. And the latter is what most people think of as drought, but
right.
In this particular part of the world, the snowpack drought is equally a problem because it translates to no water in the streams in the summer if we have a snowpack drought. And at this point, I think we're there.
We do. You would say we do have at this point a snowpack drought.
For the rest of this season, yeah, we're running real low, at least in the Dungeness.
How is data collected on the water availability in the Dungeness?
There's two important stream gauges that tell us what the flow is, how much water is flowing in the river at a given moment, and they're both continuous gauges. One's at the upper watershed. Just as the river comes out of the mountains, there's a gauge that's been there since 1923, and it's operated
by the U.S.
Yeah, we have a good long record on that. The U.S. Geological Survey operates that one, and then on the Dungeness, we have another important gauge, which is continuously reporting flow down near the mouth, right at the schoolhouse bridge near that old Dungeness schoolhouse. And that one gives us what's happening at the other end.
Are they synchronistic? I mean, do they essentially give you the same information, or does the water change as it reaches the mouth?
Oh gosh, it changes a lot because the upper gauge is going to tell you, you know, what is the flow coming into the lowlands. And then we've got four different tributaries bringing surface water in. We've got five different irrigation diversions that take water out. And then there's water, of course, flowing between surface water and groundwater immediately beneath the riverbed is really important. There's 20% of our groundwater recharge comes through the bed of the river. So even our aquifer supplies are very dependent on the river.
At this point, we are thinking about how the river is flowing. And one of the things that people are often concerned about is the salmon and how are they affected by the river flow. So I wondered if we could talk a little bit about salmon who are returning at this time of year. What do they need and what have they got? Those being two opposites.
Biologists have determined kind of in a group setting. They've studied the river flow over the years, and it was, back in early 90s, established that they kind of negotiated that a flow of 180 cubic feet per second. That's the flow. That's the amount. That's the same unit that's being recorded by those two gauges I mentioned. 180 would be a good number for salmon to be able to get back into the river and make their way up into their spawning grounds for the various types of salmon that we have.
And there are several. All five types don't come up the Dungeness, but several do.
Several do. Yeah.
That Yeah. This 180 cubic feet per minute. Is that what we're talking about?
Per second, 180 cubic feet per second.
Wow.
Yeah. You can think of it as like a basketball. Like a basketball is sort of the visual of a cubic foot, even though it's a sphere. But 180 of those per second is a good amount of flow. And we do not see that. We have not seen that much at this time of year in the river for a while. In fact, in the last 4 out of 5 years, we've had the opposite extreme. We've had more like 100, you know, closer to 100 cubic feet per second at this time of year. And that is what biologists would consider extremely low flow, to the point where, gosh, in 2015, that was the first year that it was really low. The agencies and tribes got teams of people together to help out and literally move cobbles around in the river channel to create deeper channels. And it worked. They actually saw pink salmon shooting up these new channels as soon as they stepped back from them. So it was a pink year, and there were a lot of fish waiting to migrate up, and they couldn't until these crews were out moving things around and helping.
That is an extraordinary service to the salmon. I mean, that's amazing. And this year, where are we standing in terms of cubic feet flow per second?
Today and yesterday, I was looking at the flow in the river, and the rain we got last night boosted it up to 120. Before that, it was 114. It is gradually dropping, and we do not have rain in the horizon. So I am very concerned that it is going to drop down to 100 within September. Perhaps there will be another effort to help the salmon out if they're trying to migrate it.
I was wondering about that, because the physical effort of require and the mental effort to say, okay, where do we move? Where do we make these channels, and how can we do it, and how quickly can we do it? That's really quite extraordinary, and probably not something that a lot of people think of as having happened. I mean, I remember 2015 mm-hmm. was extraordinarily rainfall drought in the extreme. But at this point, obviously, since it's not exactly known when that's going to get to that 100 or below, there probably aren't any plans to consider redoing that sort of thing. But this leaves the river working, the salmon are working to get up the river, and the people who are drawing surface water to irrigate in the Dungeness Valley are drawing water out. So those two things mm-hmm. are certainly linked. And what kinds of changes do the surface water irrigators have to make?
That's a great point. They make a lot of changes. As they start seeing the flow dropping, there's a couple of agreements that they made, and to abide by, first of all, they would never take more than half the flow. So whatever that upper gauge says it is, like yesterday, let's say it was 114, they've agreed that they would not take more than 57. They also agreed that they would always leave at least 60 in the river. So boom, right off the bat. I mean, even yesterday, before the river is any lower, they don't get what they normally would want and what their farms are wishing they had right now.
Uh-huh.
They would only be able to take 54 or whatever, 53 to make up. Yeah. So of course they have to prioritize, you know, which farms are going to get the water that need it the most compared to ones that maybe have a well or.
Well, and when we spoke earlier about the vital importance of local food supplies now and in the future. So this creates a dilemma of some large proportion because then they have to decide, okay, what can we plant and can we keep it going through September and possibly into October? So there is what we have here is a river that has more than one use. And in spite of the fact that we often just think, okay, are the salmon all right? The next thing is what's happening with farms and landscapes. And it isn't something that is going to change quickly in September, right? Right now, it is what it is.
like I mentioned, I looked at the long-term weather forecast, and there's hardly any rain predicted for the whole month of September. So I'm very worried this year.
Understandably. Does this also happen to affect one of my questions was, what do you recommend citizens do when there's this mm-hmm. kind of information? Is there a sense that there should be, or there may be a decision to at least put out some sort of alert for people to, as much as possible, conserve what water there is?
Yeah, everything helps. This time of year, certainly over here in the Dungeness watershed, there's a lot of users on the irrigation system that take their water out of the ditch for their personal garden or their personal lawn. You know, they're paying for it. They're customers or shareholders of that irrigation district, and they have the right to it. But if they can forgo, then there's a little bit more available to the commercial users whose livelihood uh-huh. and who are supplying food for the community. Conserving water, especially outdoors, of course, letting your lawn go brown and deciding, you know, how you can help. Water in uh-huh. the morning, you know, only
right.
do deep waterings and things like that.
I would take it that this would be a voluntary choice that people, not just in the Dungeness Valley, but I would say throughout the Olympic Peninsula, the situation is probably quite similar, that people would need to make some more choices to reduce their water use if they can. That isn't something that you can insist on, but you certainly have an awareness that we need to be aware of that, especially in September and into October.
It is dependent on snow, and if we have a cold enough winter, everything, it all revolves around temperature. Do we have
okay.
cold enough temperatures for the snow to fall in the mountains and then stay cold for it to harden and get dense and persist through the winter without getting rained on or getting warmed up and melted prematurely?
But there have been a couple of years when there's been an early snow melt.
Well, that's the other end of the temperature. You know, if you have really warm temperatures in April, May, and June, then your snowpack may be gone before July or August like it used to be. It takes a lot of analysis. If you looked back at the flow numbers, which I have been doing more lately, over the decades, we have such a good long-term record. It's quite noticeable that the numbers were much higher and they jumped around a lot more, which means either there were more rainfalls in the summer that created, you know, a more variable flow than we have now, or the snowmelt was kind of going through a slow and a fast phase.
But the basic point, I think, must be that what has happened historically may not apply to what can be predicted in the future.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think we have a new situation. We have, you know, once the glaciers and snowpack are reduced, they don't build back up again quickly, if at all.
It seems that as glaciers reduce their size, which is happening, the overall snow situation must change in some way. In other words, and you were saying there are fewer glaciers than there were.
It's the mass of glacier that's up there is uh-huh. much reduced. Even if you have a year where the glacier grows over the period of years in the current era we're in now, it's going down. So we have many national and global issues, but our water situation here is another one on top of it, and it's not changing. It's continuing to
persist and perhaps be even more. For some reason, the word dangerous keeps jumping in my mind, and I'm not sure that's the right word, but we think of this as being an emerald place where if there's anything we have plenty of, it's water. And that mm-hmm. is being altered by circumstances is what I hear you saying, basically.
And certainly in Squim, you know, they have that old moniker, where water is wealth. And I think that's proving true in spades.
Where water is wealth. That's a word for the entire Western United States. If you have water, you can do something. If you don't
you
have it.
You can do something, and yeah, your quality of life, you know, is wrapped up in that wealth too.
Wow. Well, do you have any closing words for this?
River flow is one of the things that affect salmon recovery, salmon runs and populations, and it's one factor, but it's one factor that people have some control over in terms of, can we adjust what we use can we be using the most efficient irrigation possible, for example? You know, can we avoid leaking irrigation ditches and not be wasting that water? There's many things that are connected, obviously. The surface and groundwater issues are very connected. I don't know what the salmon runs are looking like this year. I'm not tracking that, but I'm hoping. I've heard that the Chinook run was on the low side. So I think that there's many species that are challenged from many angles, including people. So
exactly. Wow.
Yeah.
And thank you. This is a cautionary tale that we need to pay close attention to. And I really appreciate very much that you've been able to join us and bring us a little bit of where we are right now. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The mystery sound is the American dipper, also called the water ouzel. Here's a bird with a challenging life plan. Living near unpolluted streams, the American dipper is North America's only truly aquatic songbird. Living from sea level to 12,000 feet along the Pacific coast, the Sierra Nevada, and the Cascade Mountains, as well as north into western Canada and Alaska. It catches all its food underwater in swiftly flowing streams by diving and walking on the stream bottom. It feeds on aquatic insects and their larvae, including dragonfly nymphs, small crayfish, and caddisfly larvae. It may also take tiny fish or tadpoles. It is colored gray-brown without brilliant feathers, and one observer said it looks like a wet gray stone. The thing that's interesting is they do not migrate in spite of facing frigid winter weather. They will make short distance movements to lower elevations to find unfrozen water. To cope with such extreme conditions, they have a slow metabolism, special oil to preen with, and the ability to carry extra oxygen in their blood. Other adaptions to an aquatic lifestyle are waterproof feathers and a nasal flap, which gives them the ability to close their nostrils in order to prevent water inhalation. They also have a nictitating membrane, an extra eyelid, that protects their eyes underwater. They nest on stony shores, but have been observed building behind a waterfall and flying through it to reach the nest. The water ouzel adapts remarkably to its strange chosen habitat. That's Nature Now for the first week in September. Extra thanks to Alex Henley for his engineering work on the show. Nature Now airs Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 5:05, and Saturdays at 12:30. Check for podcasts at KPTZ.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool
water.
Clear
water.
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 Keep on moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
Clear water.
The nights are cool and I'm a pool. Each star's a pool of water. Cool water.
Water.
But with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water. Moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water. Cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water. Cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? Dan's feet are sore, he's yearning for just one thing more than water. Cool water. Like me, I guess he'd like to rest where there's no quest for water. Cool. Water. Water.